is the mood of the poem Church Going by Philip Larkin, from which I have already quoted. Larkin is out cycling in the countryside when he comes across an old church and goes in. He notices the little books sprawling, the flowers cut for Sunday brownish now, and a tense, musty, unignorable silence. And he wonders what will happen to what he calls these serious houses on serious earth when they've all fallen out of use. He writes, "I wonder who will be the last, the very last, to seek this place for what it was." Before churches close their doors for the last time, they undergo a rite called deconsecration. It's a kind of funeral in which the sacredness is removed and the church becomes just another building. I know a handsome church that went through this process. It was one of the biggest churches and gorbals in Glasgow when I lived there in the 1960s, sitting proudly in the midst of a teeming neighbourhood of grey tenements. I went in search of it not long ago, wondering if I'd be able to find it among the new streets and houses that have replaced the district I knew 50 years ago. I needn't have worried. Its new setting makes it more dominant than ever. Still a thrilling building, it is now way out of proportion to its new surroundings, and it's no longer a church. St. Francis Catholic Church and Friary, built by Pugin and Pugin in 1870, was dramatically decorated in the high Gothic style, and the enormous congregation was served by a team of Franciscan friars. I remember hundreds of parishioners thronging into it for the Stations of the Cross in Holy Week. The vividly painted stations are just about all you can see of the interior now. The church was sold in 1996 and converted to a conference and community centre by the insertion of a three-storey suite of rooms into the interior. It was disconcerting to stand in the church knowing that behind the screens the original arrangements were all there as they'd been in the past, as if waiting for the day when they would be unveiled and restored to their former glory. The superintendent took me behind the elegant timber frame of the insertion to show me the high altar. He told me they still had a mass there once a year. He asked if I'd like to see the little chapel the friars once used for their community worship. We went up a short flight of stairs, and he opened a little door. I stepped into a perfectly preserved small chapel. Next to the altar, a little window opened above the nave of the church. I looked down into the great space, imagining multitudes praying, lighting candles, whispering their sins into the ears of priests in brown habits, kindling faith into flame. I was hit by a sorrow that stayed with me long after I had thanked my guide and left the church. It was partly remembrance of my own young manhood in this place 50 years before, partly dismay at the way time hurtles so many good things into the past without a backward look. So I had to remind myself that the story of religion, like everything else in life, is one of constant change and loss. The pagans were heartbroken when Catholic Christianity arrived in Britain in the 6th century and banished their gods and took over their temples. At the Reformation in the 16th century, the Catholic Church that had supplanted paganism was pushed out of Britain. Protestantism took over, and a way of life that had its own beauty and romance was destroyed. In our day, it seems to be Christianity itself that's fading away. I can understand why, but it still hurts me. That's why, like Larkin, I derive a melancholy pleasure from visiting these old shrines and imagining their glory days. What I can't mourn is the moral decay of Britain that faith leaders tell us is an inevitable consequence of the decline of religion. Moral change isn't always decay. Sometimes it's an improvement. I can look back with sadness on the vanished churches of my youth. I don't mourn the passing of some of the moral attitudes they represented. The big moral shifts during my lifetime have all been improvements. I'm thinking about the place and status of women and sexual minorities today, compared to how they were when I was young. If I were a woman or gay, I'd rather be alive in Britain now than in the Britain of my boyhood. Religious communities did little or nothing to bring about these improvements, because their sacred texts opposed them. It's hard to change an ancient prejudice if you've been taught that God commanded it. One of the useful purposes of religion in the past was the way it reinforced society's moral order by hallowing it with divine authority. Inevitably, it overdid the reinforcement. Stable societies benefit from operating a moral consensus that most of their citizens accept. But for everything to stay the same, everything has to change. For society to keep itself together and endure through time, it has to respond to the creative dynamism of the human mind and its constant search not only for new ways of making things, but for new ways of ordering its moral economy. Ethics, like everything else, is subject to change. That's why we should hold our values and moral norms with a sense of their provisional nature. We never know when we'll want to change them because we've been persuaded there's a better way to organize society. For every static world that you or I impose upon the real one must crack at times, and new patterns from new disorders open like a rose, and old assumptions yield to new sensation, as the poet Lewis MacNeice put it. Revealed religions find this hard to deal with. Their authors have persuaded them that they are in possession of a divine instruction that, unlike everything else in human history, isn't subject to change and decay. It's a mountain, not a river. It stays put and never moves. And that's why the biggest junkyard in history is the one marked abandoned religions. Abandoned because they were incapable of adapting to the flowing currents of human history. To be fair to them, some Christian groups have tried to keep abreast of the currents of human history, but they've always been double-minded about it. One of their minds telling them to rope themselves to the mountain of eternal truth, the other telling them to throw themselves into the river of time and enjoy the swim. That's why they were late in joining the campaign to emancipate women and sexual minorities, two of the great moral causes of my lifetime. That resistance to change is one reason for their decline amongst many young people today. The so-called millennial generation, both in the UK and in the USA, is the least religiously committed cohort of the population there has been in the last 60 years. So the future for organized religion doesn't look promising. There's still a spiritual hunger and interest among the young, but they show a marked contempt for institutions which claim that they alone can perfectly satisfy it. It's tough for believers to know how to respond to this situation, and I've sympathy for their predicament. They're fighting to stay afloat in the rushing flood of time, and the myth of the golden and untroubled past is always a potent attraction to those who've lost their moorings. Hence the busy reactionary churches many of us no longer feel at home in. As a tactic, it'll probably work for a while. It just doesn't work for me. But that doesn't matter. I won't be around to see how it plays out in the long run. I feel sad about that, but only a little. There are places where I can still find some spiritual comfort. If, like me, you cannot halt the search for meaning in a universe that does not explain itself, but if also, like me, you can no longer cope with the compulsive chatter of what E.M. Forster called poor little talkative Christianity, then find a place where they don't talk, they sing, and leave your soul unmolested for an hour. Slip into choral evensong somewhere, to experience the music and touch the longing it carries for the human soul. For that, you may have to find a cathedral, which brings us to a significant fact. In Britain today, cathedrals are among the places of worship that continue to thrive in an era of religious decline. There are doubtless a number of reasons for this, but I'm sure that one of them is the fact that cathedrals are spiritually and theologically more spacious and welcoming than most parish churches, and as well as music, they have more quiet corners to sit in, where you can avoid recruiters out to press-gang your mind. Cathedrals are perfectly apt for the complicated times we live in. I'm fully aware of the paradox here. I've mentioned it already. It is those who believe in the prose of religion who keep it alive for those of us who can now only survive on its poetry. I just hope they'll go on saving that space for me a little longer. I'm weary of the argument I've been engaged in all my life with religion and its volatile certainties. What I want to do with what time I have left is to cherish those I love and indulge myself in that delicious form of reflective sadness we call melancholy. There are many ways to do it. The easiest is with an old friend or colleague over a meal and a bottle of wine, when you both look back. It has been said that the past is another country. Well, visit it in your memory. Explore its foreignness and see how different you were then. Be embarrassed by that other self, but be forgiving too. None of us really knew what we were doing. We were making it up as we went along, trying to figure it out, get the hang of it, find ourselves. Smile as you remember the way it was back then. Shake your head, but be kind. And call up the dead. Remember them with fondness as well as exasperation. Their stories are over, so it's okay to try to assess them or reach a verdict on them. Don't be too hard on them. They were less sure of themselves than they seemed. It's not only the past that's another country. Most of our friends were strangers to us as well. They all had their own secrets and sorrows. The truth is, like us, they were fumbling their way through life. They were all a wee bit lost. So tenderness is all. They can't change their story now. It's told. Ours isn't. Not quite. But maybe it's time to turn our mind towards our own ending, which might not be that far away. The bus might already have left the depot. As we begin to contemplate the end of our own story, it's important to get in the right mood. The mood I recommend is the last day of the holidays, another summer gone, and the sweet sadness of leaving. Poets do reflective melancholy better than anyone else, another reason the old should read them religiously as they close the story of their lives. Here's a poem that captures the mood I recommend, Goodbye to the Villa Parana by Francis Hope. Prepare the journey north, smothering feet in unfamiliar socks, sweeping the bathroom free of sand, collecting small change of little worth. Make one last visit to the tip. Did we drink all those bottles? And throw out the unread heavy paperback, saving one thriller for the trip. Chill in the morning air, hints like a bad host that we should be going. Time for a final swim, a walk, a last black coffee in the square. If not exactly kings, we were at least frambourgeois with the right to our own slice of place and time and pleasure and someone else's things. Leaving the palace and its park, we take our common place along the road as summer joins the queue of other summers driving towards the dark. 3. Looking back. Most of us were brought up to believe we made ourselves and constructed our own destiny. God, or the universe, had given us the freedom to choose the actions that would define our characters. We could choose to be good or bad, faithful or unfaithful, brave or cowardly. When the moment of trial came, we could choose to stand fast or run away. The shorthand term for this belief is free will. The idea behind it is that each of us has agency or control over our lives. Whatever we did at any particular moment, we could have done the opposite, chosen differently. It was entirely up to us. Our actions were freely willed decisions. And it's not just a piece of theory, a philosophical issue we debate. It has solid consequences in the way societies have ordered themselves for centuries. It lies behind the criminal justice systems we have developed. It's why we build prisons and incarcerate people in them, because of the crimes they freely chose to commit. It's why people have been stoned, flogged, beheaded, burned at the stake, or drowned on ducking stools for forbidden practices they freely chose to take part in. In societies where the cruelest penalties have been abandoned, they have been replaced by public shaming in newspapers or social media, psychological ordeals that can even be more painful than physical punishment. As we say of those we punish, it serves them right. They got what they deserved. As well as these external punishments and the public blaming and shaming that go with them, individuals have internalized society's belief in free will deep within their psyches, where it prompts them into a wide repertoire of self-punishment. Disappointed at their own behavior, they go through life burdened with guilt and self-hatred. And it can darken their final years as they look back at what they have made of themselves. I am gall, I am heartburn, God's most deep decree, bitter would have me taste, my taste was me, said the poet Gerard Manley Hopkins. A friend of mine, who is an expert on Norse folk tales, wrote an essay that challenged this understanding of free will. In the essay, she explored the metaphor of weaving cloth on a loom as a better way of thinking about how our lives develop and our characters are formed. The metaphor suggests that we were more passive than active in the movement of our lives. We were never in charge. The weaver was. Another name for her is inheritance. She gathered the threads already formed by our DNA and all the other circumstances that went into the making of our unique existence, and slowly wove them into the story of our life. The threads shuttled across the loom of time, and our portrait was gradually revealed. And by old age, the picture is nearly complete, apart from a few threads yet to be tied up to finish the story. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard said that though we live our lives forwards, we can only understand them backwards when they're nearly complete. But even the perspective of old age cannot give us the complete picture, because the loom is still moving. There's still time for a final twist to its pattern. Here's how Kierkegaard put it. It is perfectly true, as philosophers say, that life must be understood backwards, but they forget the other proposition, that it must be lived forwards. And if one thinks over that proposition, it becomes more and more evident that life can never really be understood in time, because at no particular moment can I find the necessary resting place from which to understand it. Kierkegaard's resting place sounds a bit like Cupid's un-get-behind ability, the impossible place outside our lives, the only place from which we could see them in the round to justly evaluate them. Maybe Kierkegaard thought death would be the necessary resting place from which to understand them. But since we won't be there to do the understanding when we are dead, the best perspective will be to get as close as we can to death and look back from there. But what if we dislike what we see? What if we compare the person we turned out to be with the person we wanted to be and are disappointed at the difference? The performance is over, the curtain is closing, and there can be no encores. What if we give ourselves a bad review? That can be tough. Here's how the poet T.S. Eliot describes how the old can feel as they look back at events in their lives that now fill them with dismay. And last, the rending pain of reenactment of all that you have done and been, the shame of motives late revealed, and the awareness of things ill done and done to others' harm. In the medieval Ars Moriendi, the art of dying that we looked at in the first chapter, the essential element was self-examination followed by confession to a priest and absolution, all designed to keep the soul out of hell. But there was probably more to it even then than a desperate act of self-protection before it was too late. It would have had earthly benefits as well. It might have healed damaged relationships and brought peace at the end, as the final threads were drawn together and the life was completed. Whatever our view on religion and its rituals, that is still a wise approach to our end. And the reenactment of all we have done and been need not result in Eliot's rending pain. The Norse folk tale of the weaver and the loom will give us a more generous perspective than squinting at ourselves through the narrow lens of the doctrine of free will. The ways we acted, the decisions we took, all revealed the kind of person we were predestined to be, because we were never as free as we thought we were. From the beginning, we were being driven by facts and circumstances that were never in our control. But it's important to get the attitude right here. In our self-examination, we're neither to blame nor to make excuses for ourselves. We're to try to understand. It's a bit like reading a compassionate biography that tries to show how the subject came to be the person she or he was. Ah, we say, that's where all that came from. That explains it. Achieving an objective perspective on the self is hard, but it's worth the effort. Yes, we have to say, that's who I was, that's what I did. No point now in wishing I'd been someone else, someone who didn't fall apart under pressure, someone who did not betray a loved one, a better parent, a more loving spouse. For better or for worse, that's who I was. That's why the view from the summit of life can be challenging. As death approached them, I have sat at the bedsides of people eaten up with regret because of mistakes they made in their lives. Wrong roads they took, relationships broken and still unrepaired, troubled children who blamed them for their own failures. Looking back from old age can add an extra burden to what is already a difficult time. So I want to suggest a way to take some of the pain out of regret, and I want to begin by looking at a great painting from the 17th century. The painting is Peter the Penitent by the Italian artist Guercino. It was painted in 1639 and now hangs in the National Gallery of Scotland. It shows St. Peter the Apostle, his face stricken with anguish, moments after his betrayal of Jesus. Peter's betrayal is a well-known story, but it's worth thinking about again for what it can teach us about human nature. Peter was an impulsive man, a loudmouth, who was always protesting his devotion to Jesus. As it became obvious that Jesus' challenge to the religious and political authorities had placed him in danger of arrest for sedition and blasphemy, Peter got louder in his chest beating. "Everyone else may desert your master. I never will. I'd rather die than forsake you. So I say to those coming for you, bring it on. If you want Jesus, you'll have to go through me first." And it wasn't just boasting. Peter meant what he said. That's what he intended to do, because that was the kind of man he thought he was, or wanted to be. The secret police came for Jesus in the middle of the night the way they always do, and they took him away to try him, his death sentence already written. Peter followed, staying in the shadows, watching what was happening. 3 times in the hours that followed, he was challenged to admit he was a friend of Jesus. And 3 times he denied it, each denial louder than the one before. "I do not know this man," he finally screamed at them. The Gospel of Luke tells us that after his 3rd denial, Jesus turned and looked at Peter. And Peter went out and wept bitterly. Anyone who has ever let a friend or a loved one down badly will know that feeling, and Guercino's painting captures Peter's desolating grief at his own perfidy, and it makes one weep just to look at it. The thing to understand is that Peter didn't know he was going to betray Jesus until he did it. He really did love him. He really did want to die with him. Yet when it came to the test, he did the opposite of what he wanted to do. It's easy to imagine the desolation he felt after his denials of Jesus. He hated what he'd done and the kind of man it showed him to be. The fact is, he didn't know who he was till the moment in the courtyard when he discovered he was not brave and loyal. He was a weak man, as solid as water. We don't know enough about Peter to understand the factors that destined him to be a betrayer. The Gospels are not biographies, they're sketches. But a skilled cartoonist can reveal a character in a few lines. We get the type instantly because we are already aware of the complex patterns of human behavior. There are the boasters hiding from their own fears. There are the haters who despise in others desires they cannot admit in themselves. The contradictions of the self are limitless. And most of what Eliot called our self-lacerations come from our refusal to know ourselves. Let me draw some conclusions from Peter's story. In the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples, they were to say, "Lead us not into temptation," or as a modern translation has it, "Let us not be put to the test." There may have been an element of irony in what Jesus was trying to get them to learn about themselves. He was surrounded by men who boasted they would never forsake him come hell or high water. Yet when the time came, they all ran away, and the loudest boaster and the most abject failure was Peter, his right-hand man. Jesus knew how easy it was to go through life untested and therefore ignorant of our own true nature. That's why he warned us not to condemn others for failing tests we had not yet had to face ourselves. That's why the understanding Luke Jesus gave Peter broke Peter's heart. But it was also the moment Peter began to grow in self-understanding. We can go through life not knowing who we are until the right combination of circumstances puts us to the test and reveals our true character. It's as if our part in the play had been kept from us till the circumstances called it forth and we discovered who we were. But if the moment comes and our character is revealed to us, we must accept it and admit who and what we are. Once that act of self-acceptance is made, a number of healing acts can follow. The first may go against the grain of everything we have been taught about free will, but it's where we must start. We must acknowledge that our lives were propelled by factors that were never under our control. All the facts of the universe since the curtains lifted on the Big Bang created a script in which we all briefly appeared before leaving the stage to other performers. We are characters in a production that's been running for 14 billion years, and our roles were written for us long before we appeared on the scene. And we don't even know if the show has an author. All of us alive are on stage at the moment, but will soon disappear like the 100 billion human beings who preceded us. Here's Shakespeare. "Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." The philosopher Mary Warnock tells the same story in a different way. She says that if we lived in laboratory conditions where all the chance elements in our lives from birth could be exactly clocked and recorded, the choices we made as our story unfolded would appear to be foregone conclusions. She says we feel free because we are ignorant of our own genetic system and all the circumstances that program the computer that is our own brain. She quotes, Spinoza said that freedom was the ignorance of necessity. As we shiver at the coldness of this idea, we ought to remind ourselves that it also has a long religious pedigree called predestination. Religious thinkers trace everything back to God, so it was inevitable that in the compulsions of human behavior they saw the hand of God. St. Paul wrestled with the issue in his letter to the Romans. Like many of us, he was baffled by his own behavior. He writes, I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree that the law is good. So then, it is no longer I that do it, but sin which dwells within me. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. Now, if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I that do it, but sin which dwells within me. Paul was a religious visionary, not a philosopher, so he found the resolution to the puzzle of his own behavior in the will of God. We know that in everything God works for good with those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. Now, it's not clear what Paul means here, but the sense is that however mysteriously God is directing the show, and everything that happens is determined by him. That's certainly how the Protestant reformer John Calvin understood it. He was in no doubt that by predestination we mean the eternal decree of God by which he determined with himself whatever he wished to happen with regard to every man. All are not created on equal terms, but some are preordained to eternal life, others to eternal damnation. And accordingly, as each has been created for one or other of these ends, we say he has been predestined to life or death. Islam has a similar line. In the Quran, Surah 9 tells us, Naught shall visit us but what God has prescribed for us. And it is made even more explicit in one of the reports of Muhammad's table talk known as Hadith. There is no one of you, no soul that has been born, but has his place in paradise or hell already decreed for him, or to put it otherwise, his unhappy or his happy fate has been decreed for him. In all these quotations, if you substitute for the word God the words, all the facts of the universe so far, you're close to Mary Warnock's description of the human situation. In our lives, each of us was determined by factors that were beyond our control. The chances are that you won't like this description of human behavior in either its religious or its secular version. Like it or not, the facts seem to fit it. As you hear these words, two children are born in the same ward of the same hospital. Tomorrow, they will be taken home to very different parts of the same city, and their predestined stories will unfold, one to success and acclaim, the other to failure and shame. What we need to consider is whether we can alter the script already written for us in any of its versions, or whether, as Shakespeare expressed it in Lear, as flies to wanton boys are we to the gods, so all we can do is play out the hand dealt to us before shuffling off the stage. There is evidence that another story can be improvised from the script written for us, and I want to introduce it in the words of another philosopher, Hannah Arendt. Though we don't know what we're doing when we are acting, we have no possibility ever to undo what we have done. Action processes are not only unpredictable, they are also irreversible. There is no author or maker who can undo what he has done if he does not like it or when the consequences are disastrous. The possible redemption from the predicament of irreversibility is the faculty of forgiving. Without being forgiven, released from the consequences of what we have done, our capacity to act would be confined to one single deed from which we could never recover. We would remain the victim of its consequences forever. End of quote. Our tragedy is that though we do not know what we are doing when we act, our actions are irreversible. There's no rewind button in a human life, though we often wish there were. We long to go back to how things were before we uttered that word or committed that act. But we can't. That's what we said. That's what we did. The tragedy is that our acts go on to determine the behavior of those they have damaged, and the script drives the action on to the next crisis. Since art imitates life, this is the pattern we see repeated again and again in novels and plays and soap operas. As Jeremiah put it, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. Arendt suggests that the only way to change the direction of the plot is through forgiveness. Forgiveness cannot reverse the action, but it can reject or interrupt its consequences. Without forgiveness, the scripted sequence flows on, and a marriage is destroyed, a career is wrecked, a relationship is shattered. How does forgiveness happen? Like everything else in human psychology, the ability to forgive seems to be already present or predestined in some, but not in others. Nietzsche thought those who were unable to forgive and forget lacked plastic energy. I quote, "In order to determine the extent and thereby the boundary point at which past things must be forgotten, if they are not to become the grave diggers of the present, one has to know the exact extent of the plastic energy of a person. That is, the power to grow uniquely from within, to transform and incorporate the past and the unknown, to heal wounds, to replace what is lost, and to duplicate shattered structures from within. There are people so lacking this energy that they bleed to death as if from a tiny scratch after a single incident, a single pain, and often in particular, a single minor injustice." I have known people who fitted this description. Visiting them was to endure a recitation of outrage at an injury from the past, often the distant past. Most of the energy of their life was consumed in rehearsing it. They suffered from a locked-in syndrome that imprisoned them in the memory of the offence, and it played on a loop to those who would listen to it. If forgiveness is the force that frees victims from this constant playback, what prompts it? An important factor seems to be the spontaneous energy of compassion, the ability to feel or intuit another's distress. In the injured person, compassion for the perpetrators overcomes the pain of the wound they inflicted. In some cases, the compassionate person feels the offender's distress at their own action. Or the victim feels pity for the one who could do such a thing and be such a person. Wherever it comes from, one of the paradoxes of compassion forgiveness is that it can release the sorrow of offenders at their own action. This is what happened between Jesus and Peter. Jesus looked with compassion at Peter after his denials, and it caused Peter to weep. Jesus understood the misery Peter felt at discovering he was not the man he thought he was, but the kind of failure he actually turned out to be. The account of the forgiveness of Peter by Jesus for his denials comes at the end of the Gospel of John. With the tact of the artist, John doesn't tell us about Peter's forgiveness, he shows it. Jesus is dead, and Peter has gone back to his job as a fisherman on the Sea of Galilee, haunted by his betrayal of the man he loved. Suddenly, Jesus is beside him on the beach, but he does not mention the three betrayals. Instead, he asks Peter three times if he loves him. And Peter brings to his three avowals of love the same passion he brought to the denials that had broken his heart. Peter was not a vicious man. Vice is unconscious of itself. Peter was a weak man, and weakness is all too conscious of itself. What Jesus gave Peter was the gift to fail without being destroyed by it. This is one of the ways forgiveness works. Peter's threefold renewal of his broken vows could not undo his three denials. His denials were irreversible and could not be undone. But their consequences were halted by forgiveness, and a different script for the future became possible. In Nietzsche's words, the actions of Peter's past were not allowed to become the grave diggers of his future. In thinking about the mystery of forgiveness and the fact that some seem to forgive with ease and some cannot forgive at all, it is important to get the tone or the mood of our language right. It's not a matter of approving those who can and condemning those who cannot forgive. Even here, our nature seemed to be predetermined. So it's yet another aspect of human behavior we should try to understand. If the ability to forgive opens the script in a new direction and offers the possibility of a different future, the inability to forgive does the opposite. It kills and buries the future and locks the participants not only into the memory of the past, but also into all the consequences that will flow continually from it. It reminds me of people I have known who never recovered from the death of a loved one and whose life became a sustained act of mourning. No present, no future, only the compulsive memory of the past. The inability to forgive works the same way. It imprisons us in the past, whether in our personal or in our group relations. That's why most of the wars and feuds that characterize human history are the constant rehearsal of a past offense. In these communities, there's no present, no future, only the compulsive remembrance of the past. That can be true of individuals as well as of whole communities. They can be trapped in the memory of an offense they committed that has dominated their whole life. They are never able to silence the inner voice that proclaims them a failure. They had their chance and blew it. Moving on from that kind of paralysis requires what for many is the most difficult kind of forgiveness to achieve, self-forgiveness. It's hard to extend compassion to the self for the pain and hurt it has caused to others, but there's no worthwhile future without it. The secret lies in the perspective we adopt. We should bring to ourselves the same eyes, the same look that we brought to those who shared their guilt and sorrow with us. The poet Gerard Manley Hopkins understood that. He was no stranger to self-accusation and depression, so he prayed, "My own heart let me more have pity on. Let me live to my sad self hereafter, kind, charitable, not live this tormented mind with this tormented mind tormenting yet." Artists are usually better at expressing the intricacies of the human soul than theologians. Let me prove the point by looking at Edward St. Oban's series of novels about Patrick Melrose. One way to read them is as an investigation of the dynamics of forgiveness. Patrick is looking back on a life ruined by a father who abused him and a mother who neglected him. A life characterized by destructive addictions and damaged relationships. In the novel, Some Hope, he tries to tell his friend Johnny about the abuse he suffered. "How do you mean abused?" asked Johnny uncertainly. Patrick couldn't speak. The crumpled bedspread with the blue phoenixes, the pool of cold slime at the base of his spine scuttling off over the tiles, these were memories he was not prepared to talk about. He tells Johnny he was sexually abused by his father, adding, "But now I'm exhausted by hating him. I can't go on." His predicament is that he can see how his father's abuse had caused the disastrous pattern of his own life. He knew that under the tall grass of an apparently untamed future, the steel rails of fear and habit were already laid. What he suddenly couldn't bear with every cell in his body was to act out the destiny prepared for him by his past and slide obediently along those rails, contemplating bitterly all the routes he would rather have taken. A few pages later in the novel, Anne, another friend, asks if he's tried to forgive his father. Patrick replies that to forgive him, he'd have to be convinced that his father had made some effort to change the course of his life. "If he'd changed the course, he wouldn't need forgiving," said Anne. "That's the whole deal with forgiving. Anyhow, I don't say you're not wrong not to forgive him, but you can't stay stuck with this hatred." Anne's words perfectly express the human predicament. We may be justified in our refusal to forgive an injury, but it means we are stuck with the hatred we feel for the offender, and the steel rails of our bitterness propel us into the future already scripted for us. It's not till the last page of the final novel in the series, At Last, that the resolution is achieved and Patrick is able to tear up the script, forgive, and move on. He opened himself up to the feeling of utter helplessness and incoherence that he supposed he had spent his life trying to avoid and waited for it to dismember him. Instead of feeling the helplessness, he felt the helplessness and compassion for the helplessness at the same time. One followed the other swiftly. As the compassion expanded, he saw himself on equal terms with his supposed persecutors, saw his parents, who appeared to be the cause of his suffering, as unhappy children with parents who appeared to be the cause of their suffering. There was no one to blame and everyone to help. And those who appeared to deserve the most blame needed the most help. For a while, he stayed level with the pure inevitability of things being as they were, and he saw that there was a margin of freedom in that clarity. Patrick's margin of freedom was the sudden insight that liberated him from the steel rails of his own past that were forcing him towards a predestined future. Understanding the forces that controlled him gave him enough of a margin of freedom to redirect them. It is only when we acknowledge how imprisoned we are that we become free. This is not far from Spinoza's idea that, although everything is predetermined, our capacity to understand the facts that determine our behavior gives us a margin of freedom and control over it. Only when we know how bound we are can we break free? This is a paradox well understood by artists who use their genius to express the human condition. It's there in the myth of the voyage of Odysseus. Odysseus is warned that when he sails past the island of the Sirens, their beautiful voices will lure his ship onto the rocks. So, he tells his sailors to plug up their ears and tie him to the mast to prevent them being lured to their own destruction. Understanding his own compulsions gave him a margin of freedom over them. Self-understanding helps us connect our own weaknesses to the weaknesses of others and forgive them. And compassion is the energy that drives it, including compassion for ourselves. But it can be left too late. That's why the practice of self-examination is worth mastering early in life, while there may still be time to rewrite the script and make a happier story. Not that it's ever entirely in our own hands. I've known men, they've usually been men, who have died consumed with regret because their mistakes were not met with forgiveness at the time, and the steel rails running out of their past drove them away from those they loved. One of them was consumed with sorrow that he was dying without ever having met his grandchildren. An affair had broken his marriage and provoked an enduring bitterness in his wife, who made sure he lost his family when he injured her. And, of course, she lost everything as well, because her life had become an act of revenge against him. The price of her inability to forgive was imprisonment in the kind of hatred Patrick Melrose had finally managed to escape from. What harm we can unknowingly do to each other. Our own hearts let us mourn, have pity on. Bringing all this together at the end of a long and muddled life can be painful, especially if we're trying to do it on our own. This is where religious traditions can help us, even if we're not religious. Making a confession, or owning up, can be a beautiful and releasing act as we face the end of life. And we can do it in any number of ways. We can confess to a priest, if that's our style, or to a friend if we need a listening ear. But the pillow on our bed, or the flowers at the bottom of the garden will do just as well. It's only a matter of being honest, with the right mixture of compassion. Yes, that's who I was, we can say with a sigh. That's what I did. Wish I hadn't, but it's too late now. Forgive me. Then we should let it go. The last bus is on its way. For then what? What will it be like, our last moment alive? The chances are that we won't be alert enough to notice it. Our doctors will try to make it as easy as possible, so we may not be conscious when we finally slip away. But suppose we are. Suppose we are aware till the very end. Will we notice it? Will we know it is the final moment? Will there be any sense of pulling up anchor and casting off? There's an old poetic tradition that imagined death as a sea journey. In Greek mythology, everyone had to pay Charon, the ferryman, in order to cross the river Styx, the boundary between the worlds of the living and the dead. Other poets have used the same metaphor. To describe the moment of death, Tennyson used the image of crossing the sandbar to catch the tide where the river meets the sea. Such a tide as moving seems asleep, too full for sound and foam, when that which drew from out the boundless deep turns again home. Is this pure artistry, or is there some collective memory in humanity that poets draw on when thinking about death? The poet Michael Donaghy used the analogy of the car ferry to anticipate his own early death, as if he were standing on the passenger deck of his own body, looking down on the skilled frenzy of the workers on the pier as they released the mooring ropes and sent him out to sea. You will do the very last thing. Wait then for a noise in the chest, between depth charge and gong, like the sea doors slamming on the car deck. Wait for the white noise and then cold astern. Gaze down over the rim of the enormous lamp. Observe the skilled frenzy of the physicians, a nurse's bald patch, blood. These will blur, as sure as you've forgotten the voices of your childhood friends or your toys. Or you may note with mild surprise your name, for the face they now cover is a stranger's and it always has been. Turn away. We commend you to the light, where all reliable accounts conclude. When death finally arrives, will we see it coming or watch ourselves leaving or casting off? Is it possible to imagine what that might feel like and what our reaction might be? Maybe because I'm writing this book and thinking about death constantly, I had a dream recently in which I knew that my moment had come. It was a standard falling dream, according to Freud, one of the most common and universal types. They are usually described as fear of falling dreams, and analysts have offered many interpretations of their meaning. The fact that they are as common as they are suggests that they carry a straightforward anxiety about stumbling off a great height. I've known people who suffered from vertigo and could not walk up a hill as unthreatening as Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh without having to summon colossal resources of courage. I don't have that fear, but I've felt its opposite. I've looked down from a high cliff and wondered what it would feel like to throw myself off or let myself drop. There is obviously something in dreams of falling that expresses either a brute fear of or a dangerous attraction to losing control of our bodies and their purchase on reality. It's only a short step to a more psychological interpretation in which falling is not about losing physical traction but about losing safety or purpose or meaning in our lives. Inevitably, experts offer us their interpretation of these cloudy experiences. I have no desire to join the queue of interpreters, and I know that other people's dreams are the archetype of tedium, so I'll be brief about my dream. As I was having it, I knew that it was not about the fear of falling, it was about the experience of dying. I was drifting into empty space like an astronaut separated from a satellite. I remember the strange weightlessness, the sense of having nothing to hold on to anymore. The dominant feeling was of resigned curiosity. "So this is what it feels like to be dying," I said to myself as I floated away. Then I woke up. The experience was of dying, not of being dead. Being dead is beyond or past all experience, but dying isn't. It is something we can take part in, be aware of. I hope I am alert when it happens, so that I can greet it and in some sense own it or choose it. The novelist Henry James is said to have recognized it when it came for him. "So here it is at last, the distinguished thing," he exclaimed. That suggests that though we might recognize death's approach, whether as a tide we catch, or as a bus drawing to a halt at our stop, or of falling into space, it's hard to imagine what the moment of leaving will actually feel like, the event of death itself. Until recently, no one came back to tell us, but with the successes of modern medicine, that has changed. Now we have the testimony of many people who claim to have died and been restored to life by their doctors. They even have an acronym to identify themselves, NDEs, people who have had near-death experiences, or in the shorthand of the movement, experiencers, and a movement they have certainly become. Millions of copies of books have been sold that describe and draw metaphysical conclusions from people who have died and been brought back to life. So what do they tell us? Most of them recount experiences of pleasure and acceptance. A common claim is that their souls were released from their bodies and hovered over them in the hospital room, watching what the poet Michael Donaghy described as the